Our final speaker this morning will most certainly affect you in the way that you conduct your life. The story that he's about to relate will prove as meaningful and as important to you as perhaps any speech that you may ever hear. I see him as absolute proof of man's ability to overcome incredible odds, to persevere in times of inhumane conditions, to become stronger when weakness would be much easier. His name is Gerald Coffey, Captain Gerald Coffey of the United States Navy Air Command. He was commissioned in 1958 and awarded his wings a year later. He is now Fleet Air Operations Officer on the staff of the Commander-in-Chief Pacific Fleet. Captain Coffey's experiences during these 22 years in the Navy are awe-inspiring indeed, particularly when you learn that nearly one-third of this time was spent as a prisoner of war in Hanoi. Ladies and gentlemen of the Million Dollar Roundtable, will you join me in extending an extra special welcome to Captain Coffey? Jerry.
Thank you very much, Jack, and thank you for that welcome. It's certainly consistent with the very gracious hospitality that you have all extended to my wife and me since we've been here, and we appreciate that very much. I think that probably one of the most difficult things you have to do as a salesman of life insurance is to convince your prospective clients that it doesn't always happen to the other guy. I'm living proof of that fact. To have been a prisoner of war all that time is a rather dubious distinction, I think. I would have considered myself more successful to have survived that deployment that I was on and have come back and deployed several more times, flown the combat missions that my contemporaries did, and to make my contribution in that way. However, that wasn't to be the case, and I found myself fighting my own kind of war in a different way, in a different place. It's an experience which happened a little over 7 years ago. That is, my release occurred a little over 7 years ago, and it seems more like something that I read about in a book rather than having had happen to me personally. Part of the reason for that, I think, is because life has been so good these past 7 years. My family and I have crammed a lot of living into these 7 years, and we've been very blessed. And because it happened so long ago, I don't think it does us any good to dwell upon the experience per se. It's more important, I think, considering the problems that we face in the present and the immediate future, to dwell upon those things of the present and the future, and only those things of the past by which we can learn important lessons. So I'm not here today to tell you in so many words what it was like to be a prisoner of war there, much in the same way that I debriefed my intelligence officer upon my return. It's more important, I think, to relate to you the most important lessons that I learned, the lessons which contributed the most to my survival and to that of my contemporaries there during all those years. And not only that, but how those very same lessons have served me so well since I've been home and will continue to. And lastly, I hope to explain to you and to give you some insight into how it was so much more than just my experience alone, but that of yours as well. Every single one of you, individually, experienced this with me and with my friends there. And perhaps that will become more apparent as we go along also. This experience of ours yours and mine, began in February of 1966. I was flying a reconnaissance mission off the decks of the USS Kitty Hawk in the Tonkin Gulf. I was launched on the last launch of the last day on the line before the carrier was supposed to go into Hong Kong for 10 days of liberty. And that was one of my greatest regrets. But you can be sure I've since made up for that. My aircraft was hit by small arms fire, and the hit itself wasn't so tremendous, but it severed the hydraulic lines of the aircraft, spilling all the hydraulic fluid, thereby precluding my ability to steer. The engines were working great, and as soon as we took the hit, I turned the aircraft toward the sea to get as far out as possible to enhance our chances of rescue. I accelerated, went into burner, and the airplane did accelerate. However, as we were going across the beach, the control stick froze in my hand, and the airplane began to roll, and it continued to roll and went more and more rapidly with the nose dropping toward the horizon, and it became apparent to me that my crewman and I wouldn't be able to stay with the airplane. So I yelled to my crewman over the intercom, "Eject, eject, eject." I didn't hear him go, so I reached up and pulled my own face curtain, which automatically ejects him first, and then myself a split second later. Because by that time, we had accelerated to about 680 miles per hour, I was knocked unconscious immediately. And for all practical purposes, had I never regained consciousness, I would have died then. And many of my friends used to say, instead of "when I was shot down," they would say "when I was killed," because it was so close to the same thing. I regained consciousness 10 or 15 minutes later, I'm not really sure how long, floating in the water about a quarter of a mile off the coast. Unconsciously, due to the repetition of my training, I had released my parachute, my oxygen mask, deployed my survival kit, and inflated my flotation gear, all subconsciously, without realizing it, with a broken arm, dislocated elbow and shoulder, and many cuts and burns and bruises. My crewman was about 50 yards away, already inflating his life raft, and there were several boats full of North Vietnamese coming out toward us, shooting in the water around us and over our heads, and there were no aircraft overhead. And it appeared to us that escape was simply out of the question. And it was. Very shortly, the first boat pulled up alongside of me and very roughly pulled me inside and began stripping me of my survival gear. And just then, two of our own aircraft did finally show up overhead. And not realizing that we were in those boats, they began rolling in on strafing patterns with machine gun bullets bracketing our boats once across the bow. And I could remember pulling myself up and watching those planes rolling in as the bullets would bracket the bow and then the stern and then the bow and the stern. Finally, after six or seven passes, they broke it off, realizing that we had in fact been picked up by the boats. As soon as we reached the shore, we jumped out on the breaker line and ran across a very wide expanse of beach and dove behind a rice paddy dike, just as another aircraft rolled in and fired a pack of rockets and blew those boats to splinters. Sometime during the battle for our capture that day, my crewman, my friend, was killed. I'm not really sure how. He was either killed by our own aircraft strafing or by the Vietnamese out of excitement or revenge, or his boat was sunk. But I never saw him again. And that was my introduction to North Vietnam. Well, our trip to Hanoi took about 6 or 7 days because we were very far south in the country of North Vietnam. And we traveled by a Russian-built jeep-like vehicle across very ruddy, bombed-out roads. We forded rivers and went across pontoon bridges because most of the regular bridges had been bombed. And during that trip, every time we made a stop at a hamlet or some group of buildings, I would convince myself that we had arrived at the POW compound in which I was to be kept. And all that time I was looking for that classic case, such as the POW compound that you may recall from that old World War II movie, Stalag 17. Or the TV series, Hogan's Heroes, you know, where the guard's kind of a roly-poly guy and they laugh and scratch and the guys sit around and they have mouse races and bed cigarettes and play the guitar a little bit and some volleyball. That's not too bad. Can last out the war at that rate. So when we reached the capital city of Hanoi and pulled up in front of that huge fortress-like prison called Hoa Lo, and Hoa Lo in Vietnamese means fiery forge. It was named by the Vietnamese themselves, by their treatment that they received under the French there during the days of colonialism. I was taken through those big iron gates of Hoa Lo prison and down the corridors into my first cell, shoved very roughly inside, and the heavy wooden door slammed behind me, and the iron bolt clanged home with a note of finality. And I looked around and couldn't believe where I found myself. I was in a tiny cell about the size of a single bed. There was a concrete slab on one side coming out of the wall about 18 inches wide, and that was to be my bed, at the foot of which was a set of ankle stocks, wooden on the bottom, and a heavy iron bar that came down across the top with a large padlock. There was one window very high in the cell with a double row of iron bars through which all I could see was the top of that 18-foot wall which surrounded the entire city block-sized prison. Shards of broken glass embedded in the concrete on top and strands of barbed wire above that. There was one small can in the corner of the cell that was supposed to take care of all my physical needs. And the cell just reeked of the human misery, the decades of human misery that had been there before me. And I think the first thought that might have gone through my mind was something like, hey, babe, this ain't the Navy that you shipped over for, you know, and indeed it wasn't. Because, like every naval aviator flying from the decks of an aircraft carrier, it always happens to the other guy. Although we are prepared, it's going to happen to someone else, not me. That period of initial adjustment there where the realization of my plight really began to sink in, that in fact I had been captured and that I was a prisoner of war. And those initial interrogations and torture sessions were intense. Sometimes when you'd only have time to come back to your cell and sort of lick your wounds and take a big breath and get ready for the time that you knew was sure to come when those keys would rattle outside your door at the wrong time of the night again. That was a very difficult time. And you can be sure that I prayed a lot. At first, as I recall, my prayers were kind of futile. I remember saying something like, God, if you just give me those last 5 minutes to fly over again, you can be sure I'd fly somewhere else for starters. Or futile, like, God, please get me out of here as soon as possible. Get me home to my loved ones, to my country, Lord. I don't really care how. Let there be a military victory, a political settlement, a POW exchange. God, I don't care how, but please let it be soon. I don't know how long I can endure this. And honestly, if at that time I had realized that it was going to be for 7 years and 9 days, I don't know what I would have done. As I would pray, the realization of the futility of those prayers began to sink in. And I would say to myself, this just isn't going to do. And finally, my prayers took a new turn. A new turn to sound something like, okay, God, if this is the way it's going to be, for however long, then God, help me to make it count for something positive. It has the potential, if you will, to be my personal dark ages of this period of time, however long. Help me instead to turn it around to my personal renaissance. God, help me to learn something new every day, to emerge from this experience a better man in every way that I can. Help me to go home a better American, a better citizen, a better officer, a better husband and father, a better friend to all of my friends. God, help me to make it count for something positive. Well, after that point, which I consider a turning point in my prayers, and in comparing notes with my friends there at later times, we all reach that point sooner or later. My life took on a new meaning, for indeed, every day there was something to accomplish, something new to learn, and it helped the time go faster because we had confidence that we weren't living in a vacuum, but something was being accomplished, indeed. And as I would pace back and forth in my cell there in those early days, taking three steps in turn, and I've developed quite an empathy for lions and tigers that I see in the zoo pacing back and forth in their cage, walking several miles a day at that rate, I would dwell upon the fact that when I returned, and although sometimes it was difficult, I never thought that I wouldn't, when I returned, there would be opportunities just like this. Opportunities to share that experience, the things that I had learned, how I'd survived. And I would ask myself at that time, what are you going to say? How can you keep from blowing this opportunity, which may last 20 or 30 minutes at the most? What are you going to share? And that entire time I was in prison, I didn't know what the answer to that question was. And I didn't know until I returned home to America in February of 1973. And when I returned, I found a very different country, a different America, a different society, a different world in so many ways. And if you'll project yourselves back to that period between 1966 and 73, and think about your own changes in your family, your community, the changes that you saw in our nation. We're still suffering from the trauma of Vietnam, and it was to get worse when South Vietnam fell. It was almost as if we could foresee the problems of Watergate coming upon us. Our society had become so complex. And it finally occurred to me that the same key to my survival there in prison during those years would serve me well on a daily basis at home in America. And the key to that survival was faith. Faith. Not just spiritual faith, that of course. But first of all, faith in myself as an individual to hack it, to get it out, to last as long as I was going to have to. Faith in the men around me, my fellow man, if you will, in the fellow Americans, the Vietnamese, my fellow Americans and family at home. Faith in my country, America. The principles upon which it's founded, which have made it endure, and faith in God, in my God. And I'd like to share with you how those aspects of faith served me so well in prison and do on a continuing basis right here at home. First of all, faith in ourselves as individuals. Faith in ourselves to adjust and to accept that new situation. Faith in ourselves to resist the exploitation, the efforts of the enemy to extract military information and propaganda through writing letters or making tapes or encouraging other prisoners newly shot down to cooperate with the prison authorities. Faith in ourselves to minimize the net gain that the enemy could receive by having us at his total mercy. Keeping faith in ourselves to stay fit physically. By walking those several miles a day, keeping our muscle tone up, doing push-ups, sit-ups, deep breathing exercises, you name it, anything to maintain the muscle tone, to be ready to face whatever might come around the corner the next day, whether it be a forced march to China or more torture. Keeping faith in ourselves to stay alive mentally, not letting our minds and brains atrophy. And we developed several means of doing this. Memory work was one of the primary ways of staying busy and active mentally. We memorized the books of the Bible and the capitals of the states all alphabetically. There was one time when I had memorized over 450 names of other American prisoners that I'd received through our communication system there. And I would go over them every other day or so, all alphabetically, and I had 27 A's or 35 B's and 42 C's, and maybe I'd only come up with 41 C's that one day, go back over my C's to make sure I didn't drop that one. Because if I should have an opportunity to escape or be released for whatever reason, I could share with our government and the families of those men who the prisoners were, because the North Vietnamese certainly weren't putting out the word. Memorizing all of the old French, German, Spanish vocabulary words that we could extract from our high school and college language days, and passing those in grammar rules through the walls. And when I returned and went to Berkeley for 2 years, pursuing a master's in political science, I achieved 2 years of college credit by exam for the French that I learned through the walls of Hanoi. One of my Air Force contemporaries there was a real godsend. He knew poetry. It seemed that when he was a youngster, his mother used to force him to learn a brand new poem to recite to the annual Thanksgiving family reunion. Every year, he hated it. But she made him do it. I guess he wouldn't get any turkey for dinner or something, but he always did. But more amazingly, he retained so much of that poetry, and he began passing it through the walls to us. Classics such as Shakespeare's sonnets and the poems of Rudyard Kipling, Ballad of East and West, the poem If, Gunga Din. We memorized Alfred Noyes, The Highwayman, and when I was released, I had memorized, committed to memory, about 35 or 40 poems, some of them very long and epic, with dozens of stanzas. And we particularly appreciated the poems by Kipling, particularly for their masculine appeal, I think. It was interesting that a stanza from Kipling, poem If, was quoted yesterday. And I'd like to quote another one that meant so much to us. If you can force your heart and nerve and sinew to serve their term long after they are gone, when there's nothing left within you,
except the will that says to them, hold on, hold on.
One of my other friends there in Hanoi composed a very short, succinct poem which very aptly described the Vietnamese attitude and approach toward us. It simply said, poor wretch in misery and pain, who showed improper attitude when he did openly complain, was made to suffer even more to teach him proper gratitude for his pathetic plight before. And it was just a vicious circle. Well, as we began to develop this appreciation for poetry, we all tried our hand at composing poetry. And I say composed rather than wrote because we had no pencil and paper. And if you wanted to compose a poem, you just made it up line for line and memorized the lines and then the verses and so on. And I'll never forget my own first attempt at composing poetry. Sometimes to break up our usual rice diet, we had bread, and it would come in a little crust, kind of like a small French loaf. But you can be sure that wherever the flour for that bread was kept in those dungeon-like prisons of Wallow, there were bugs and weevils and lice and roaches and so on, so at least we had a little protein supplement in our bread when we got it. But I was sitting on my concrete slab one day, and I took a bite out of my bread, and I composed my first poem. I said, little weevil in my bread, I think I just bit off your head. Of course I had, and that poem went downhill after that. It didn't get any better. But as I was sitting there in the sweltering heat of a Hanoi summer, my body covered with heat rash, not knowing whether, when, or if I'd ever go home, I found myself laughing, and I thought, God, you must be going off your rocker, you know. But I wasn't. I was maintaining that sense of humor, that axiomatic sense of humor that is known to be found in American fighting men. And that was brought forth again later on in a part of Wallow Prison that we had named Heartbreak Hotel. And it was called Heartbreak Hotel because it was where you were usually taken after your initial interrogations, whether they lasted 2 weeks or 4 weeks or a month and a half. Heartbreak Hotel consisted of a small cell block of 8 cells, 4 rows on either side of a center passageway. And old cell number 8 had been converted into a shower. By that, I mean a rusty pipe just ran up the wall and then over at the top so the water could run on your head. Inevitably, every man would be taken to cell number 8 so he could bathe, and the guard would shove him in very brusquely and slam the door and say, wash! And you'd be left alone. And you'd reflect back over those previous weeks and feel about as low as the vermin that was scurrying across the decks of old cell number 8 there, because inevitably, you were disappointed in yourself. No matter how you'd done, you hadn't been as tough as you thought you would be. And it was hard to accept. Well, you'd strip off the tattered remnants of your flight suit if you had that left, or maybe the ill-fitting shirt or shorts that some peasant might have loaned you on the way to Hanoi. Turn on the cold water of that shower and stand there and hang onto the pipe and let it run over your head. And pretty soon you'd look up, and there, at eye level, scratched indelibly by some American before you, were the words, smile, you're on candid camera. And you would, of course, and it made all the difference in the world, and you could turn yourself around, keeping faith in that sense of humor, keeping faith in your ability to maintain your priorities and your sanity and your sense of values in an Alice in Wonderland, Lewis Carroll world where people don't even use the same dictionary. Keeping faith in yourself to obey that American fighting man's code of conduct, those 6 articles which prescribe the behavior that is expected of us in those circumstances. Keeping faith in ourselves to minimize the net gain to the enemy. Faith in ourselves to be tough, to last, to endure for as long as necessary. Well, when I returned to America there in February of 1973, I looked around, and because of the changes, I saw such a lack of faith in ourselves as individual Americans, and still do to a certain extent. A lack of faith in ourselves to look around us and see the things that are wrong and still believe that we can make a difference in changing them, to make them right. A lack of faith in ourselves as individual citizens to still maintain control of our system and to contribute positively. A lack of faith in ourselves as Christians or as spiritual believers to believe that no matter how much we may falter, how we may sometimes fail and be disappointed in ourselves, that we can still bounce back, you know, and to keep faith in our ability
to do that.
A lack of faith in ourselves to espouse our beliefs, whether they be patriotic or spiritual, and not be embarrassed about doing it.
This is the end of Side 1. Please turn the tape over for Side 2.